Peter Stride was uncertain what to expect as the boy stepped into the open hatchway high above him. Then next to him appeared a plump, middle-aged woman in an expensive but rumpled high-fashion silk dress, probably a Nina Ritchie, Peter decided irrelevantly. The woman's elaborate, lacquered hairstyle was coming down in wisps around her ears, but she had a kindly, humorous face, and she placed a protective arm about the boy-child's shoulders. The next person was a taller and younger woman, with a pale, sensitive skin. Her nostrils and eyelids were inflamed pink from weeping or from some allergy, and there were blotches of angry, prickly heat on her throat and upper arms. Under the loose cotton maternity dress, her huge belly bulged grotesquely, throwing her off balance. She stood with her thin white legs knock-kneed awkwardly, and blinked in the brilliant, sparkling sunshine, her eyes still attuned to the shaded gloom of the cabin. The fourth and last person was a young girl, and with a sudden, blinding stab of agony below the ribs, Peter thought it was Melissa Jane. It took a dozen racing beats of his heart before he realized it was not her. But she had the same sweet Victorian face, the classical English skin of rose petals, the finely bred body of almost woman, with delicate breast buds and long coltish legs below narrow boyish hips. There was naked terror in her huge eyes, and almost instantly she seemed to realize that Peter was her hope of salvation. The eyes turned on him, pleading, hope starting to awaken. "Please," she whispered, "don't let them hurt us." So softly that Peter could hardly catch the words, "Please, sir, please help us." But Ingrid was there, her voice rising stridently. "You must believe that what we promise, we mean. You and your evil capitalist masters must understand completely that we will not let a single deadline pass without executions. We have to prove that for the revolution we are without mercy. You must be made to understand that our demands must be met in full, that they are not negotiable. We must demonstrate the price for missing a deadline." She paused. "The next deadline is midnight tonight. If our demands are not met in full by then, you must know the price you will be made to pay." She halted again, and then her voice rose into that hysterical shriek. "This is the price!" And she stepped back out of sight. Helpless with dread, Peter Stride tried to think of some way to prevent the inevitable. "Jump!" he shouted, lifting both hands towards the girl. "Jump quickly, I will catch you." But the child hesitated. The drop was almost 30 feet, and she teetered uncertainly. Behind her, 10 paces back, the dark-haired Karen and the blonde, lion-maned girl stood side by side. And in unison, they lifted the short, big-bored pistols, holding them in the low, double-handed grip, positioning themselves at the angle and range which would allow the mass of soft, heavy lead beads with which the cartridges were packed to spread sufficiently to sweep the backs of the four hostages. "Jump!" Peter's voice carried clearly into the cabin, and Ingrid's mouth convulsed in a nervous rictus, an awful parody of a smile. "Now," she said, and the two women fired together. The two shots blended in a thunderous burst of sound, a mind-stopping roar, and blue powder smoke burst from the gaping muzzles. Flying specks of burning wadding hurled across the cabin, and the impact of lead shot into living flesh sounded like a handful of watermelon pips thrown against a wall. Ingrid fired the second barrel a moment before Karen, so this time the two shots were distinct, stunning blurts of sound. And in the dreadful silence that followed, the two men in the passenger cabins were screaming wildly, "Nobody move! Everybody freeze!" For Peter Stride, those fractional seconds seemed to last for long hours. They seemed to play on endlessly through his brain, like a series of frozen frames in a grotesque movie. Image after image seemed separated from the whole, so that forever afterwards he would be able to recreate each of them entire and undistorted, and to experience again, undiluted, the paralyzing nausea of those moments. The pregnant woman took the full blast of one of the first shots. She burst open like an overripe fruit, her swollen body pulled out of shape by the passage of shot from spine to navel, and she was flung forward, so she somersaulted out into space. She hit the tarmac in a loose tangle of pale, thin limbs, and was completely still, no flicker of life remaining. The plump woman clung to the boy beside her, and they teetered in the open doorway. Around them swirled pale blue wisps of gun smoke. Though she kept her balance, the tightly stretched beige silk of her dress was speckled with dozens of tiny wounds, as though she had been stabbed repeatedly with sharpened knitting needle. The same wounds were torn through the boy's white school shirt, and little scarlet flowers bloomed swiftly around each wound, spreading to stain the cloth. Neither of them made any sound, and their expressions were startled and uncomprehending. The next blasts of sound and shot struck them solidly, and they seemed boneless and without substance as they tumbled forward, still locked together. Their fall seemed to continue for a very long time, and then they sprawled together over the pregnant woman's body. Peter ran forward to catch the girl child as she fell, and her weight bore him to his knees on the tarmac. He came to his feet running, carrying her like a sleepy baby, one arm under her knees and the other around her shoulders. Her lovely head bumped against his shoulder, and the fine silken hair blew into his face, half blinding him. "Don't die," he found himself grunting the words in time to his pounding feet. "Please, don't die." But he could feel the warm, wet leak of blood down his belly, soaking into his shorts and dribbling down the front of his thighs. At the entrance to the terminal buildings, Colin Noble ran out a dozen paces and tried to take the child from his arms, but Peter resisted him fiercely. Peter relinquished the frail, completely relaxed body to the Thor doctor, and he stood by without word or expression of regret as the doctor worked swiftly over her. Peter's face was stony, and his wide mouth clamped in a hard line when the doctor looked up at last. "I'm afraid she's dead, sir." Peter nodded curtly and turned away. His heels cracked on the echoing marble of the deserted terminal hall, and Colin Noble fell in silently beside him. His face was as bleak and expressionless as Peter's as they climbed into the cabin of the Hawker command aircraft.
"Sir William, you pointed us for holding enemies of the state without trial." The foreign minister leaned forward to point the accuser's finger. "But you British discarded the citizen's right of habeas corpus when you passed the Prevention of Terrorism Act. And in Cyprus and Palestine, you were holding prisoners without trial long before that. Now your H block in Ulster. Is that any better than what we're forced to do here?"
Sir William, the British ambassador, gobbled indignantly while he collected his thoughts. Kelly Constable intervened smoothly. "Gentlemen, we are trying to find common ground here, not areas of dispute. There are hundreds of lives at stake." A telephone shrilled in the air-conditioned hush of the room, and Sir William lifted the receiver to his ear with patent relief. But as he listened, all blood drained from his face, leaving it a jaundiced putty colour. "I see," he said once, and then, "Very well, thank you," and replaced the receiver. He looked down the length of the long, polished Imbuya wood table to the imposing figure at the end.
"Prime Minister," his voice quavered a little, "I regret to inform you that the terrorists have rejected the compromise proposals offered by your government, and that 10 minutes ago they murdered 4 hostages."
There was a gasp of disbelief from the attentive circle of listening men. "The hostages were 2 women and 2 children, a boy and a girl. They were shot in the back and their bodies thrown from the aircraft. The terrorists have set a new deadline, midnight tonight, for the acceptance of their terms, failing which there will be further shootings." The silence lasted for almost a minute as head after head turned slowly, until they were all staring at the big, hunched figure at the head of the table. "I appeal to you in the name of humanity, sir.
It was Kelly Constable who broke the silence. We must save the women and children at least. The world will not allow us to sit by as they are murdered.
We will have to attack the aircraft and free the prisoners, said the Prime Minister heavily.
But the American ambassador shook his head. My government is adamant, sir, as is that of my British colleague.
He glanced at Sir William, who nodded support.
We cannot and will not risk a massacre. Attack the aircraft, and our governments will make no attempt to moderate the terms of the UN proposals. Nor will we intervene in the Security Council to exercise the veto.
Yet if we agree to the demands of these animals...
The last word was said fiercely. We place our nation in terrible danger.
Prime Minister, we have only hours to find a solution. Then the killing will begin again.
You yourself have placed the success chances of a Delta strike as low as even, Kingston Parker pointed out, staring grimly at Peter Stride out of the little square screen. Neither the President nor I find those odds acceptable.
Dr. Parker, they are murdering women and children out there on the tarmac.
Peter tried to keep his tone neutral, his reasoning balanced.
Very strong pressure is being brought to bear on the South African government to accede to the terms for release of the women and children.
That will solve nothing. Peter could not restrain himself. It will leave us with exactly the same situation tomorrow night.
If we can secure the release of the women and children, the number of lives at risk will be reduced, and in 40 hours the situation might have changed.
We are buying time, Peter, even if we have to pay for it with a heavy coin.
And if the South Africans do not agree? If we come to the midnight deadline without an agreement with the hijackers, what happens then, Dr. Parker?
This is a difficult thing to say, Peter. But if that happens...
Parker spread those long, graceful hands in a gesture of resignation.
We may lose another 4 lives. But that is better than precipitating the massacre of 400. And after that, the South Africans will not be able to hold out. They will have to agree to free the women and children at any cost.
Peter could not truly believe what he had heard. He knew he was on the very brink of losing his temper completely, and he had to give himself a few seconds to steady himself. He dropped his eyes to his own hands that were interlocked on the desktop in front of him. Under the fingernails of his right hand were black half-moons, the dried blood of the child he had carried back from the aircraft. Abruptly he unlocked his fingers and thrust both hands deeply into the pockets of his blue Thor overalls. He took a long, deep breath, held it a moment, and then let it out slowly.
If that was difficult to say, Dr. Parker, console yourself that it was a bloody sight harder to listen to.
I understand how you feel, Peter.
I don't think you do, sir.
Peter shook his head slowly.
You are a soldier.
And only a soldier knows how to really hate violence, Peter finished for him.
Our personal feelings must not be allowed to intrude in this.
Kingston Parker's voice had a sharp edge to it now. I must once again forcibly remind you that the decision for Condition Delta has been delegated to me by the President and your Prime Minister. No strike will be made without my express orders. Do you understand that, General Stride?
I understand, Dr. Parker, Peter said flatly. And we hope to get some really good videotapes of the next murders. I'll let you have copies for your personal collection.